For over 2 years now, with few exceptions, we have been studying the written works of Moses. Much of what he wrote was narrative storytelling, and after that, he devoted a great deal of his work to recording laws. After all that, we have only a few opportunities to see Moses' more poetic side. Now, if you followed along through our sermon series on the book of Exodus, you know that Moses composed, or at least transcribed, a song of celebration in Exodus 15 after the people of Israel crossed the Sea of Reeds. But you might not have known that Moses also wrote the 90th Psalm. It seemed to me that since we have devoted so much time to studying the life of Moses, that we would do well here to interject a brief study of his psalm. Therein, we will read of Moses' reflections on the brevity of life and his prayer on how it should be used in response. Your passage, then, is Psalm 90. If you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. The psalm opens, in the first two verses, with a comment on God's age. In verse 1, Moses directs his prayer to God, here called Lord as in Master, translating the Hebrew Adonai, stating that he has preceded all generations. This, of course, makes God particularly ancient. The verse also tacitly praises God for having served as a refuge for his people throughout all that time. Verse 2 continues the theme, explaining that God predates even the mountains. The mountains, of course, are a particularly potent picture of age. Living longer than some humans is not much of an accomplishment, but outliving the mountain, which not only predates humanity, but which has scarcely changed in human history, really means something. And it isn't just the mountains that God has beaten. God is older than the world, and not only older than the world, but he is so old that he created the world. Indeed, verse 2 concludes, God has been God from forever past and will continue to be God into forever future. God is eternal. But then we contrast this with the age of man. Men came from dust, and men return to dust. God is forever, and a man is for little more than never. Verse 4 tells us that 1,000 years, a breadth of time which no man can live, is like a day to God. Or to make the comparison even grander, that millennium is like nothing more than a watch in the night, just a few hours, like something we would sleep through. Verses 5 and 6 continue the theme, noting that compared to God, man is trifling and easily swept away, like a flood might sweep something away. We are as brief as a dream, passing by in this hour of the night and almost always immediately forgotten. We are like a blade of grass that buds in the morning and withers by the end of the day. So then, Moses' introduction has made the case clear. God is eternal, and man is as nothing. And why is mankind as nothing? Well, because of our sin, of course. Moses reiterates the point that was made in the Torah, that sin kills. Man was originally made with an eternal nature, to live forever, but it was our sin that brought death into the world. Sin, Moses notes in verse 8, cannot be hidden from God, but sin is easily exposed in his light, and as a result of sin, God's wrath rightly pours out on us, and we are brought to an end. Moses, of course, ended up having very direct experience with such things, having seen God's wrath poured out on Egyptians and stiff-necked Israelites alike. Verse 9 continues the theme of life's brevity. Our days under God's wrath, it tells us, are short and hard, and likened to a sigh. Verse 10 notes that our lives are short, maybe 70 or 80 years. The time we have is difficult and is quickly over. Now this verse calls for particular scrutiny. The verse is very interesting in that it records the length of a human life as being 70 to 80 years. That, of course, draws much attention in part because Moses himself lived to be 120 years old, care of Deuteronomy 34, and at the time of the Exodus, Moses was already 80. See Exodus 7 for that. Some have claimed, then, that there is some kind of contradiction here. But that is just silly. We should remember that this is poetry we're reading, not a medical journal. So we don't expect that Moses was setting any kind of hard limit which mankind cannot cross. He was speaking in generalities about a common human lifespan, and was doing so to demonstrate the brevity of human life when measured against God's eternal nature. We also note that it would be very reasonable for Moses to expect that his own life would end at 80 years if he was younger than that when he wrote this psalm. Surely he couldn't be expected to live to 120, die, and then go back to amend the psalm to say how old he was. My supposition is that Moses was in his 80s when he wrote this, at a time very close to his interaction with God on Mount Sinai, but we have no clear indication of his age when he wrote it. It could have been written before he ever interacted with the burning bush. I'm sure that even in his younger days, when he was fleeing from Pharaoh and living in relative solitude in Midian, that he had plenty of reason to believe he was living a short and difficult life full of sighing. But however old he was, if an ordinary person in his day didn't live past 80, it would be reasonable for Moses to state this average age in his psalm. We have people today who live to 120, but because it is so rare, we don't expect it. And in speaking of the length of a human life, particularly in a poetic fashion, we wouldn't find it at all strange to call a human lifespan 80 years either. I think this verse is also particularly interesting in that it shows us how little the human lifespan has actually changed since the time of Moses. In general, we tend to think that advances in technology, health, and medicine have given us vastly longer lifespans than the ancient person could possibly have hoped for. But that really isn't the case. Now, it is true that the reported average life expectancy has gone up in modern times compared to the number reported in the past, but this is largely due to a much greater likelihood of surviving childhood, and also to some dishonesty in the numbers. Children, you see, have weaker immune systems than adults and are therefore more likely to be killed by diseases that would not kill a normal adult. A much more accurate measure of a person's general longevity would take into account how long a person who survives to adulthood could expect to live. We also note that wars were more frequent in past times, so many people died in their teens and early 20s who might have otherwise had much longer lifespans, dragging down the life expectancy considerably. So, for example, we could look at the life expectancy numbers from the 1700s and find that a person could only be expected to live an average of 40-some-odd years, but that's because so many children and men died young. We could compare that to the founding documents of the United States from the same period and find that the Constitution sets a minimum age for a president at 35 years. Well, with a restriction like that, if a person was really expected to die in his 40s, then we'd guess that the founders expected a lot of presidents to die in their second terms, but that clearly wasn't their expectation. They wrote that age into the Constitution, knowing that people could expect a much longer lifespan than that. So, while we might read that there was a 40-something-year-old life expectancy at the time, we also find that Thomas Jefferson, the third president, lived to be 83 years old, and John Adams, the second president, lived to be 90. So while the average age at death was significantly lower in centuries past, the actual age at death for an ordinary person was not significantly lower than what we might see today. And then there's the monkeying with the numbers. Newborns are prone to suffer from a wide range of diseases and abnormalities, birth defects and such, which could kill them. Every time an infant died in years past, his short life was averaged into the life expectancy as a zero. Sadly, today, if a child in the womb is found to have a potentially lethal weakness, he is killed in the womb, and then his lifespan isn't counted at all. Removing a bunch of zeros from the average might move the life expectancy up on paper, but since abortion is now the leading cause of death in America, if all of those deaths were factored into our life expectancy, it would be much, much lower. In fact, I would guess that if abortion was averaged in as it should be, American life expectancy would immediately return to historical norms. But that doesn't change the fact that we have people commonly living into their 70s and 80s, and in rare cases, surviving all the way to 120. And while we can look more deeply into such numbers in more recent centuries, we have no real reason to expect that life was significantly different for the ancients. Obviously, life expectancy has varied considerably among sexes, social classes, and nationalities over time, but we have here an ancient historical record, which even the modern atheist scholar cannot deny predates the Roman era, and which accepts without qualification that people in ancient times commonly lived to their 70s. and the Bible, of course, is chock full of such claims. Outside the Bible, we also have it that church historians told us John the Apostle died sometime after 98 AD, meaning that if he was in his 20s when Jesus was crucified, he lived to be about 90. So if some snarky atheist tells you that the Bible can't be trusted because everyone in the Bronze Age died in their 40s, tell him to take a hike. He's dealing with the speculations and questionable numbers of people who aren't examining the actual historical records, and he doesn't understand how life expectancy works. Also of note in verse 10 is Moses' comment that, at the end of our few years, we fly away. And of course, we're dealing in a poetic context, but flying away seems like it would be a curious way to describe death if Moses did not believe in an afterlife. The Torah is generally focused on the here and now, not the hereafter, but it does give some hints that there is life after death. And while this passage, of course, isn't technically part of the Torah, it is a part of Moses' writings, and it does seem to reference an afterlife. Verse 11 speaks of God's wrath. Moses here notes that God's wrath is just. God has been wronged, and he deserves satisfaction against those who have wronged him. Standing before God, we have no right to complain about our suffering. And as God's power is great, so we should fear him. We deserve to suffer at his hand, and so the only proper response is to stand before God with fear and humility, with the knowledge that he owes us nothing, and that we owe him everything. From here on, Moses starts to get into what I read as some pertinent moral lessons related to our longevity. God is infinite in his power and in his age, but we are weak and sinful, and as a result, we deserve God's wrath. Ultimately, some measures of that wrath come to us in death. We are all finite in that way. And so in verse 12, Moses makes a request, not that his life should be long, but that God would teach him to number his days. Moses isn't going to try and escape his just punishment, but he does ask that he be given the wisdom to use the time well. When we are young, our lives look as if they will last forever. Often young people don't think about how quickly life will pass, and as a result, they live carelessly in their youth. At worst, they plant sins when they are young and reap consequences for a lifetime. But other times, they simply waste their energies on fruitless pursuit. Years later, they wake up one morning to find a wrinkled face in the mirror, and they ask, "What have I done with my life?" But whether you are young or old, you have only a short time to live on this earth, and how you use that time will determine whether or not you will be a valuable influence. So whatever amount of time you have left on the earth, I hope that you will do as Moses did, and seek for ways to use your life wisely. Moses also asks that God would relent, giving us a respite from his fury to at least enjoy ourselves in the brief time that we have before our death. He asks that God would show us compassion, that he would give us satisfaction in his love, that he would give us reasons to sing for joy, and that he would give us at least as many pleasurable years as he gives us years of struggle. So first we must learn to number our days, using our time to the fullest. But in our striving to do good in this world, we must also remember to stop and smell the roses, to enjoy ourselves along the way. Life is hard, but we must be intentional about finding joy amidst the struggle. Particularly, we should find joy in God, who, despite his just anger, loves us and has given us a life and a world far better than what we deserve. And finally, we should live in such a way that we leave behind a legacy. It is good policy to leave any place better than you found it, and the earth is no exception. In the final two verses, Moses asks that God would give us the simple blessing of success in our work, and that God's good deed of blessing us would be a benefit to our children. In life, you will probably have no greater joy or greater influence than your children. In numbering your days, remember that the good you do for them is not only that which will cause your greatest impact on the future, but also that which will make your life the most fulfilling. If you leave behind children who are more righteous, more wise, better educated, more skilled, and more wealthy than yourself, then you will leave the world a better place, and you will probably have lived a better life yourself in the process. So then, we have studied the prayer of Moses. Moses' prayer glorifies God in that it recognizes his great power and eternality, while contrasting those things against human frailty and mortality. In response to this, Moses asked God that he would give us an awareness of the limitations of our time, so that we would have wisdom to use our short time well. Specifically, he asked that God would give us joy in our lives, success in our work, and blessings for our children. And so that same prayer is my prayer for you. And my advice is this, that you work hard, be diligent, enjoy what you have, and do good for your children. That, I believe, is the path to living your best and most successful life, and to leaving the world better than you found it. For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.